It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin has 42 Republican delegates up for grabs in today's presidential primary. We'll talk about what role these delegates could play in this summer's Republican Party convention. First, today is Wisconsin's spring primary election. It's also the first major election with Wisconsin's voter ID law in place. Mary Swakuza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is with us now to tell us how things are going on the ground at the polls today. Mary, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So far, general impressions. What are you seeing at the polls?
I was actually just at the polls because I realized I hadn't voted yet, and I would be having a late night here at the office. And it was really busy, actually. The poll workers said that they have been pretty swamped. I had a small polling place, and they were already over 1,000 voters by about 1 p.m., and it looks like it's going to be a busy day there.
And I know that the Journal Sentinel is tracking what's happening today, as are all the major papers in Wisconsin, all eyes on it. There has been a high prediction of turnout for today. Now, based on what you've seen and what you've been hearing, is that coming out to be true?
I think so. I think at least it's sunny and not snowing, and people seem to be going to the polls. They are open until 8, so I don't think we'll have any kind of final turnout numbers anytime soon, but I definitely think we are seeing a really high turnout, especially for an April election.
And we have the new voter ID law in place this election. Any sense of how voters and poll workers are dealing with that?
You know, I have heard that there has been just a little bit of confusion among people about what they need to vote, what kind of ID, what kind of proof of residency, if they've moved, that sort of thing. I haven't heard of any major problems of, you know, people not being able to vote or having to cast provisional ballots. Certainly here and there that's been happening, but I have not heard of any just kind of widespread crisis going on.
And you said it's looking busy based on what you've seen. Are people reporting long lines, or are there expected to be long lines as the day gets later?
I think that there have been in some polling places that are going to see, you know, especially high turnout. And I think we'll just have to kind of monitor that. Obviously, if you're in line by 8 p.m., poll workers want you to stay in line because you can vote if you've already gotten to the polling place and you're just waiting.
All right, we'll leave
and
it there.
I think those lines might get a little longer after, you know, after work, too.
Well, thanks for making time, Mary. I know it's going to be a long night. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Mary Swakuza, reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us today to talk about how things are going so far at the polls in Wisconsin today. Now we turn to another primary election story, this one out of Arizona. The Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice is investigating how the Maricopa County Recorder's Office handled Arizona's primary election in late March. Voters stood in line for up to 5 hours to cast their ballots in that county, which cut its polling places from 200 in 2012 to 60 for this year's primary. Christopher Conover has been covering the story, and he joins us now. He's a political reporter for Arizona Public Media. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
So what happened at Arizona's primary election on March 22nd?
Well, as you said, the big story was out of Maricopa County, which is where Phoenix is, for people not familiar with the counties in Arizona. And as you correctly said, the number of polling places were cut back to 60 countywide, and people ended up standing in line for hours and hours and hours. The last vote was cast just before 1 a.m. local time, when polls close at 7 p.m.
Any sense about why that cut was made from something like 200 to 60 in terms of the polling places?
The Maricopa County Recorder, who oversees elections for Maricopa County, a woman named Helen Purcell, quickly came out and initially blamed independent voters. In Arizona, in presidential preference primaries, only those registered with a party, Democrat, Republican, or Green, can vote. Independents can't vote. And she initially said, well, a lot of people were in line who weren't eligible to vote. She walked that back fairly quickly and just said in the end she made a mistake. She underestimated the number of polls that she needed open based on Arizona's early voting laws and turnout the last time we had a presidential primary.
Has this ever happened in the history of Arizona primaries?
We've had lines, as the reporter you were just talking with said, there are always lines for an election, a big election like this, people just getting in line before the polls close. But nothing like this, not hours and hours and hours of waiting.
So you said that the last polls closed at something like 1 a.m. in the morning. So does that mean that the polls stayed open to accommodate everybody who was in line?
The polls did stay open. What they did is they sent a poll worker to the end of the line at 7 o'clock and said, okay, everybody in front of me gets to vote. Anybody not in line at 7 o'clock behind me doesn't get to vote. That way they were the last person in line, and the very last vote was cast just before 1 a.m. in Maricopa County.
And how did authorities in Arizona react to the trouble that people had voting in that primary?
The state legislature is in session. Very quickly, the House Elections Committee called a special committee meeting, brought the Maricopa County Recorder in front of the committee meeting, brought the Secretary of State in front of the committee meeting, and Arizona's legislature is Republican-dominated, and they gave the Republican County Recorder a piece of their mind, to say the least. And the meeting was open to the public, and public testimony was allowed. She was blasted by the public. She was blasted by members of the legislature. It was a long day for the County Recorder, and she just kept apologizing. We'll see if what laws are changed. One of the things that may change is the Attorney General wants to stop the reporting of numbers until the last vote is cast, because the way our law works here in Arizona, at 8 p.m., an hour after the polls close, the counties and the state can begin reporting numbers. He said that's not fair for those still standing in line. There are investigations, as you mentioned, from the U.S. Department of Justice and the Arizona Secretary of State's office into what happened. And Maricopa County has promised during the special election we have coming up on a local issue in May and our regular primaries in August and then in November, this will not be a problem again.
Were there any particular groups of people who were affected by these long lines at the polls?
That's an interesting question. A lot of people have tried to say this is a case of voter suppression. I just got off the phone, actually, with the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and she didn't really come out and even say that minorities or women, typical Democratic voters, were necessarily disproportionately affected as compared to Republicans in this. Some Republican members of the legislature were upset that there were no polling places in their legislative districts in Maricopa County. So it seems to be pretty wide cut across demographics and Republican versus Democrat, but that is one of the things that the Department of Justice has asked for. They want to see voting registration numbers and where those polls were placed.
Now, as you said, this was not obviously the general election. There are more voting days around the country. Are there any lessons to be learned for other states about what not to do at the polls on voting days?
It sounds like, in some ways, don't underestimate. We had very high turnout in Arizona. Each party had turnout in the high 40s, which overall brought our turnout in the high 40% percentile range, which is good turnout for a primary. So I think the lesson here is don't underestimate how many people are going to come out and vote this election based on previous elections.
Do you know anything about how people do estimate, the people who are in charge of running state elections, how you get a sense of who's going to show up at the polls?
What county recorders and election officials have told me is, first, they look at the historic trends. How do similar elections fare with turnout? Arizona has a wide-ranging early election law, so we begin voting essentially a month before Election Day. So they look at how many ballots were sent out. They put all those numbers together and you know, kind of stick their finger in the wind, I think, a little bit to see how involved people are, and then come up with how many polling places need to be open. In this case, Maricopa County says that was the part that broke down. They just underestimated based on the number of early ballots that had gone out and what had happened in previous elections.
Is there any sense that, you know, maybe this is just an exceptional year with a historic presidential election, or is it more of a we messed up in Maricopa County?
A lot of it is we just messed up in Maricopa County. A budget argument became part of the discussion during the legislative committee. Is the state giving the counties enough money to run these elections? Did that figure into part of the decision that the counties just didn't have the money to open up enough polls? The legislature really poo-pooed that idea, but it was brought up. Like I said, the elections officials statewide have said this will not happen in the upcoming elections. They will make sure that more polling places are open. Only time will tell on that, but I can't imagine that in Maricopa County, at least, that they'll stick with those 60 polling places.
Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Christopher Conover, political reporter for Arizona Public Media. He joined us there to talk about the U.S. Department of Justice's investigation into long wait times during the Arizona primary in Maricopa County. Now, presidential candidates have spent a lot of time in Wisconsin over the last week or two as they geared up for today's primary election. The state has 42 Republican delegates up for grabs, but those delegates may be on the sidelines this summer if this year's Republican race ends in a contested convention. Scott Bauer joins us now to talk about what role Wisconsin's delegates could play in the Republican convention this summer. He's a correspondent for the Associated Press. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how are Wisconsin's Republican delegates awarded to candidates?
Well, just like everything in this process, it's a little bit convoluted. So what happens is we are voting today, and there will be a candidate or candidates who win delegates. There are 18 awarded state to the statewide winner, and then three delegates for each winner in each of the eight congressional districts. So conceivably, you could have more than one candidate with delegates, but you could have certainly one candidate with all 42. What happens then is, starting tomorrow, there are these caucuses, these congressional caucuses, where party leaders meet to determine who the actual person will be as the delegate, serving as the delegate at the national convention. And then there will also be a meeting in May to determine who the statewide delegates are, the people who will represent the 18 delegates who go to the statewide winner. So then those people will be the ones who go to Cleveland, represent Wisconsin, wear the funny hats, do all the things the delegates do. And, of course, this year, perhaps more than any in recent memory, there's a lot of attention on the rules and who these people are and what may happen when they get to the floor there in Cleveland.
Right. So to get the big picture here, the Republican candidate, whoever that person may be, they need 1,237 delegates to clinch their nomination. But it's looking as though it's entirely possible that none of the candidates will hit that magic number. Wisconsin tonight may change that story a little bit, but what happens then?
Yeah, so right now, 1,237 is the magic number, and right now the last count that I looked up that the AP has on delegates has Donald Trump with 737, Ted Cruz with 475, and John Kasich with 143. So mathematically, Kasich cannot get to 1,237. For Cruz to get there, it's nearly impossible, and Trump can get there, but if he loses Wisconsin, it becomes considerably more difficult for him to get to the 1,237. So part of the narrative on Wisconsin is not just who wins or loses, but what it means certainly for Donald Trump as he goes forward, and whether he may go into the convention without the 1,237. And so that is what everyone talks about when you hear talk about an open convention. It's going in there without a candidate who's got the majority required to get the nomination. And when that happens, there's a whole series of things that kick in that include, you know, rounds of balloting where you take a vote. Everyone who's pledged to the delegates that they're pledged to in the various states cast their ballots. Nobody gets to 1,237. And then you start going down the line. You have a second ballot, third, fourth, however many it takes until you get the nominee. So that's where you hear a lot of the talk about what rules are going to be in play, when will delegates be able to switch allegiance to someone else, will a candidate who's not even, who didn't even run for president, will they be able to come in? Will John Kasich even be, you know, on the ballot because he doesn't meet the requirements that he won eight states? I mean, it gets really complicated very quickly.
Right. I mean, that sounds like a long and potentially excruciating process. Any sense of how long that entire process could take in an open convention?
No, I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, the $64,000 question right now. And if you hear interviews with Reince Priebus, the RNC chair, who, of course, is from Wisconsin, he tries to exude a very calm outlook on this whole thing and says that, you know, the rules will be the rules and this will play out and we will have a nominee and the party will become united behind that person. But, of course, behind the scenes, you have the candidates who are still in the race and their surrogates and everyone angling to make sure that they have people lined up to be their delegates who will be loyal to them throughout several rounds of balloting that won't switch from one to another after they've cast that first vote that they're required to cast. So there's high potential for all kinds of skullduggery behind the scenes before you get to Cleveland under that open convention scenario.
We're talking with Associated Press correspondent Scott Bauer right now about what's going to happen with the delegates in an open convention on the Republican side. And so Wisconsin delegates, the rules are a little different. We've been talking a lot about these scenarios in which the delegates become very important and they can switch allegiance in different rounds of voting. But Wisconsin's delegates, it sounds like they're going to be bound to sort of a stricter set of rules. What are the rules for Wisconsin delegates?
Yeah, so the rules here for the Wisconsin Republican delegates are that they must support their candidate that they're pledged to until one of two things happen, until either that candidate releases them and says you're free to support someone else, or if that candidate does not receive one-third of the total votes cast in any vote for the nomination. So what you could have happen is in the first round, everyone has to vote for who they want to vote for who they're pledged to vote for. They do that. No one gets the majority. So then you go to the second round. In other states, the rules may be different, and those delegates who voted for, let's say, Trump in the first round could be free to vote for whoever they wanted to in the second round. In Wisconsin, they could not bolt under state party rules unless that candidate says it's okay or that candidate did not get a third of the overall vote. However, it's not clear what the penalties would be if they violated those party rules and did something else.
Right. Has that ever happened where we look back through history and there were delegates who bucked the rules?
I'm sure there probably were times. I'm not familiar with what they may have been. But again, this isn't anything that's really been in play for decades, really. And so everyone is kind of brushing up on what the rules are. And you have to remember, these state party rules, these national convention rules, they change every 4 years. You know, there's always tweaking that goes on. There's always changes that happen. You hear that on the national level now. There was a lot of blowback from how the rules were implemented in 2012 and calls for them to be changed now. And you've certainly got people on both sides of that issue saying, no, you know, we want to play by the rules as they stood in 2012, and others saying we want to change those. And there will be a rules committee that meets the week before the RNC convention that sets the rules for the national convention. So obviously there'll be a lot of attention brought to bear on that at that point.
And, of course, there's this scenario that refuses to die, that there is a dark horse candidate, Paul Ryan perhaps, who emerges from an open convention. And then you've got these bound Wisconsin delegates. Are they more likely to jump ship then and vote for Paul Ryan?
Yeah, that would be an incredible scenario, of course, if you had somebody like Paul Ryan brought in and you know, what happens to his people in his home state? What do they do? Of course, you've got Paul Ryan's people and he himself saying that that's not going to happen. And you've got that he's not going to be brought in any kind of scenario. And then you've got other people saying, well, you know, that's exactly what he said when they were talking about him as being Speaker of the House. So why should we believe him now? I mean, obviously, it's a pretty incredible scenario to think that somebody who didn't even run for president might get the nomination. And it's one that the candidates who are still in the race certainly are discounting and speaking pretty forcibly against. Ted Cruz said yesterday in Milwaukee that, or here in Madison, that it would be that there is no white knight coming in to save anyone in this. That one of the, it's either him or Trump. You know, that's the way he sees it. And so, whatever happens, it's going to be a fight for sure.
And Scott, just briefly, not as dramatic on the Democratic side, but are Democratic delegates hamstrung in the same way that the Republican delegates are by the primary election winner?
Yeah, so the Democrats is considerably different. There's a lot more delegates. There's 96 at play in the election today. 86 of them are bound by who gets the vote, and they're awarded proportionately statewide and both congressionally. And then you have these 10 superdelegates who are not bound. They can side with whoever they want. So in one scenario, you could have, let's say, Bernie Sanders winning statewide, but you could also have all 10 superdelegates pledging to Hillary Clinton if they wanted to. And we already have 5 of the 10 have already said that they're pledging themselves to Hillary Clinton even before the primary vote takes place. So you've got a very different scenario over there with the Democrats, and but again, they don't have the same kind of scenario playing out with the Republicans on the possibility of having an open convention. I think the narrative is a little bit different for them than it is for the Republicans.
Definitely a lot to watch. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me.
That was Scott Bauer, correspondent for the Associated Press. Monday was a win for advocates of a minimum wage hike. California and New York both elected to gradually raise their minimum wage over the next few years to eventually hit that $15 per hour mark. And a UC Berkeley study said the wage hike would help more than a third of workers in California. But the move isn't without criticism. Opponents of the $15 minimum wage say it could end up raising prices and ultimately lead to higher unemployment. Joining us now to tell us more about who gains and who loses from a $15 minimum wage is Stephen Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, how significant is this move for California and New York to both commit to a $15 minimum wage over the course of the coming years?
It's actually a pretty significant move, because what it does is that it kind of lays the foundation for other states to start to follow up and do the same thing. We're not really seeing any movement on the minimum wage at the federal level, so what we're seeing are states stepping in and essentially saying we need to do this ourselves. And that's how oftentimes you'll see big movements at the federal levels. The states kind of take the lead and move up.
Are you seeing a movement like that aside from New York and California?
There are a few other states that have been kicking it around, but I think the timing of it right now is California and New York are really kind of out in the front on this one. I don't expect to see kind of a rapid snowballing of other states following them.
So without this kind of move, what kind of wage movement have we seen over the past decades?
It's been very flat. We have not really seen much in terms of average wages going up. What we're seeing is kind of growth at the lower income level. A lot of the jobs that we've been generating have been lower income jobs, and we're seeing growth at the very high income level. So that middle there is just kind of stuck where it's at.
And is there any kind of consensus among economists about here's what will happen if the minimum wage is raised to $15 an hour? Do we agree?
No. There is general consensus within the academic literature that moderate increases in the minimum wage over a sustained period of time has not negatively impacted unemployment rates or job growth. But these are generally incremental changes, and over a period of time, jumping to $15 an hour, even if it's over the next 4 years, that's a pretty big jump. So a lot of what we know from the past may not apply here.
If you look at a lot of the reporting about the $15 minimum wage raise in California and New York, you see the term uncharted territory a lot. So what kinds of questions do economists have?
I think that's exactly what's going on. It's one of the things that is really unclear is that it's not, we can't say specifically that this will cause this to happen, because it depends on where you live. If you're in and the last time we talked about this, we talked a lot about kind of the cost of living. And I think that plays a lot into how this will eventually play out and impact local economies. If you live in San Francisco or Los Angeles, this will have pretty much a minimal impact on the economy. But if you live in, a remote rural part of California or the eastern or the western part of New York, it could have a very different impact.
And what about if you look at other states who might be considering this, a state like Wisconsin? If Wisconsin were to consider a hike like $15, maybe more modest, what would you expect to see happen here?
One, I don't see a $15 increase in Wisconsin right now. I don't think that the cost of living issues that is driving a lot of this in California and New York, I don't think we see that here. And I think that the a $15 increase in Wisconsin would do more damage than good.
Looking at the conversation surrounding minimum wage, there is the economic argument and concerns that maybe it will ultimately lead to some unemployment, that it could challenge small businesses, that it could raise prices. But then you have the moral argument saying, well, this is obviously something that's going to help struggling families. So how do you frame the debate?
Well, it really kind of comes down to a value judgment. I mean, what is more important to you, a livable wage or simply having a job? I think that most folks that are not working at minimum wage jobs or jobs that are slightly paying above minimum wage, they don't think they're being affected by this. But I think that that's really not quite true. There's actually a fair amount of evidence out there that suggests that folks that are working minimum wage, they're working full-time employment at minimum wage or slightly above minimum wage, and they're eligible for government support programs, which means that my tax dollars is going to support a company that is paying low wages. So when you think about it that way, it's suddenly, wait a minute here, do I feel comfortable with my tax dollars going to support a company that is paying low wages? And I'm not sure about that.
We're talking with Stephen Deller right now, an economist from the UW-Madison, looking at the minimum wage raise hike, which is going to happen in California and New York, looking at, maybe what would happen in Wisconsin as well. And you can call us with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. And Steve said, you don't think we're going to see that here in Wisconsin, that the cost of living isn't what it is in California and many places, in New York. What might you expect to see in Wisconsin, if any change?
I think what we'll probably end up doing is essentially following the federal guidelines. I don't think that Wisconsin right now is in a position to, either politically or economically, to kind of follow the lead of California or New York. So I think we're basically going to wait and see what happens to particularly our neighboring states.
Is it, as some economists have framed it, either to a state like Wisconsin or on a national scale, is raising the minimum wage to $15, is it fair to say that it's a potential threat to the economy?
If it's done rapidly, I don't think it will hurt the economy to the extent that some of the naysayers are putting out there. I think you will see some of it filtering through on prices that folks pay. Someone's got to pay for that increase in wages, and I think the consumer will probably pay for some of it. But I think you will also see a number of smaller businesses that are perhaps operating on a thinner margin or lower profit rate, that they simply can't absorb that. So I think the thing that we have to worry about is what position are Wisconsin small businesses in to kind of absorb that kind of an increase. Now, I think what we'll see is a lot of these businesses will simply say, okay, you're no longer a hired employee, you're a paid contractor, and simply circumvent the rule altogether.
Well, what about proponents of the $15 minimum wage? You say, yeah, but we're going to put that money back into the economy. We're going to invest it. We're going to spend more at businesses because we have more money.
That's true. You do see, and this is something that economists tend to agree on, is that when you see like tax cuts, a lot of the research is done related to cuts in the income tax. And almost uniformly, the research is consistent, is that if you give lower income folks a tax benefit or a tax cut, they will spend all of that money. Whereas if you give higher income folks a tax cut, they will spend a little bit more, but not nearly as much as the same as the lower income. So if the policy is to get more people spending more money, you want to get money into the hands of lower income folks. So from that perspective, it will help kind of give a little shock to the economy.
Do we know who exactly it is who stands to benefit the most from a $15 minimum wage raise?
I think it's the working poor. It is the folks that they're working full-time jobs, or they're able to put together full-time work through part-time work. The ones that are having a difficult time paying the rent, putting food on the table, buying clothes for their children. I think those are the folks that will benefit the most. Clearly, they'll benefit.
And in terms of people being hurt, would you say, again, those small businesses that you were talking about who might have trouble absorbing?
Yeah, I think it's the smaller businesses. And when I say smaller businesses, I mean, you know, less than 10 employees, less than 20 employees. You know, they're not in a position to kind of absorb that. I think those businesses will start looking at simply contracting.
We're talking with Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, talking about the recent move to raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour in California and New York, which would make them the highest minimum wages in the country. We're picking up the conversation with Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. We're talking about New York and California's recent minimum wage hikes to $15 an hour. And we want to know how something like that might affect you or your community if that were to happen in Wisconsin. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. How do you feel about Wisconsin's current minimum wage? Call us at 800-642-1234. And Steve, you said this is not going to happen in Wisconsin. It's not likely. $15 an hour is not the same sort of purchasing power as it is in California. But would a hike to the minimum wage be bad for the state? Would $15 be bad for the state?
I think $15 would be too much. I think a couple of dollar increase would be well accepted and probably well received, but I think a jump to $15 an hour is just probably too much for most Wisconsin small businesses. You have to remember that a lot of the job growth, most of the job growth in Wisconsin is coming from new business startups, and most of these tend to be small businesses. And if I'm trying to get a business off the ground and I'm looking at starting at $15 an hour, that's going to be really difficult for me, given the Wisconsin situation. I think if I'm looking at $10 an hour, you know, which would be an increase over the minimum wage, I think that's, you know, more palatable. But 15, that's too big of a jump. I think that's why a lot of the folks are saying that this is kind of uncharted territory.
Is $2 in Wisconsin, is that something that's palatable? Is there an appetite for doing anything like that in the state right now?
I think that there could be. I think that there's probably a sufficient number of Wisconsinites that would be comfortable with a $2 increase. But again, it depends on, you know, how long is it phased in. If you were to throw it in and say, we're going to go to a $2 increase tomorrow morning, I think that would probably shock the economy a little bit too much. But if we say we're going to phase it in a dollar this year and a dollar a year from now, phase it in over a couple of years, I think most businesses could adapt to that.
As an economist, does this move surprise you? In fact, that this is almost a movement now. You've got California and New York, some other states looking at it as well. And we saw it sort of reach national attention with the fast food strike in the recent year or two. Does this surprise you that this is picking up traction?
Nothing coming out of California surprises me. But as I was preparing to come over this afternoon, there was a story on CBS Market Watch and related to this. And the story was new starter homes in San Francisco as low as $1 million. A starter home, $1 million. I can't, you know, I've been here for 25 years, and I can't come close to paying something like that for a house. So again, it really depends on your cost of living.
Got a couple comments here from Facebook and email. Here's an email from Gary in Iron River who says, money doesn't fall from the sky. If minimum wages go up, the money to pay for that comes from the company or the company's customers, it doesn't make new money. So is there sort of a cyclical way that what goes around comes around, and it just doesn't, as Gary says, grow on trees or fall from the sky?
That's exactly right. And that's why, you know, larger businesses are in a better position to absorb this. I mean, like a Walmart or a bigger box store, I'm thinking Menards maybe, they're in a better position to absorb this and continue to operate. But when we were talking smaller businesses, which again is kind of the backbone of the Wisconsin economy nowadays, it's really going to be fairly difficult for a lot of these businesses to absorb that. I think this is where they'll need to either pass it on prices to their consumers, or go the route of simply saying, okay, you're not working full-time anymore, you're working part-time, or you know, you're no longer a paid employee, I'm going to subcontract you. So I think that Gary is right, that, you know, we need to be conscious of, you know, how our business is going to be able to absorb this.
If you look at this against the backdrop of income inequality, the lowest paid in the economy and the highest paid, and you look at some place like California, where the difference is, as you were pointing out, a little more stark there, is a $15 minimum wage going to do anything to address that?
San Francisco is an outlier. New York City is an outlier. But I think it points to how housing costs have really been going up. You know, we saw the housing bubble burst, but, you know, we're actually seeing housing costs going back up. So it's going to help some folks. It's time will tell.
Looking at the idea of job loss and whether raising the minimum wage to something like $15 could ultimately lead to job loss, is that kind of question, is that realistic in the economy these days?
It is. I mean, there will be an adjustment period. And I think that, you know, we're going to lose some jobs with that big of an increase. And I think that's why we're in uncharted territories. I think a more modest increase of a couple of dollars spread over a couple of years, I think, would be much more helpful. I think one of the things that we need to think about is, you know, what kind of wage do we want? What type of jobs do we want in Wisconsin, where I'm working full time and I'm still eligible for public support programs? There's something wrong with that picture, and I think we need to be thinking in terms of that.
To that kind of question, here's a comment from Sam, who says, a single parent with a college degree supporting three children and working three jobs, sometimes five jobs, a $15 an hour wage would be have a significant impact upon my children and I, and I would love to have only one or two jobs making a living, maybe not a great one, and have more time and energy to be a better parent. Sam getting at the personal costs on lives or payoff, not cost, that this would have on families. Is that another bottom line to look at about how is this going to change the day-to-day lives of families and what they're able to afford and how to care for their children?
Oh, definitely. I think that's one of the, I'm not sure I want to say moral questions that we want to raise or the ethical question that we want to raise is that, you know, what is, if I'm working full-time, what is a minimum acceptable level of income if I'm working full-time? And I think that Sam raises a very good point. For a lot of folks in today's economy in Wisconsin is you oftentimes have to piecemeal together a couple of part-time jobs to make it go, and it's still not making ends meet. In that regard, I'm sympathetic to seeing an increase in the minimum wage.
Talking to Stephen Deller from UW-Madison, and we're talking about a potential $15 minimum wage, what that would look like in the country. It is going to happen in California and New York. What would it look like elsewhere? And we'll take a call now from Scott in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi, yes. I had a comment on the $15 is probably deserved. We need to do an increase, but it's a little bit too much at one time. I think people are going to be that are making $15.50 an hour, $16 an hour, they're going to feel like they're being, you know, they should be paid more. So it's not just the minimum coming up. It's everybody else thinking, well, they're going to need more money because you know, I'm in the position that here and even Wisconsin, that I'm going to have more money if the minimum goes up to them. You know, it's not just a lot, you know, it's a large amount too fast. I think it should have been done slower.
All right, Scott, thank you so much for that. Scott thinks it's too much too quickly. What do you say to that?
Well, Scott, I think you raise a very good point. There was a company in, I want to say Seattle, that about half a year ago decided that everybody in the company, regardless of their position, was going to make a minimum of $75,000 a year. And it made all sorts of national news and, you know, this is great, this is great. After it's happened now, you touched on exactly what happened is you had folks that were making $75,000 beforehand, middle management, what have you, and now everybody's making that same amount of money, and it kind of ruffled some feathers in that particular company, and you saw some middle management leave because of that very issue. So, I mean, there's an adjustment period. I think I agree with you that $15 an hour is too much, too fast. And not appropriate for Wisconsin.
Thanks a lot for that call, Scott. And Stephen, just briefly, what happens if the $15 minimum wage does end up doing more harm than good, since it seems like it would be hard to step that back once it's implemented?
You're right. I mean, once it's in place, you're not going to be able to step it back. And I think that California, the California economy, the New York economies are sufficiently dynamic that they're probably going to be able to absorb it. I think if Wisconsin were to implement it and our neighboring states did not implement it, I think that it would probably not be a very good idea.
And we're going to leave it there. Steve, thank you so much for coming to the studio and talking with us today.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much.
We are talking there with Stephen Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. And he joined us to talk about minimum wage hikes of $15 an hour, California looking to do that, New York saying they too are going to be doing this, starting in New York and then heading out to the suburbs of New York, and what that might signal about the minimum wage here in Wisconsin. And you can weigh in. You can tell us what you think about the minimum wage. Say your piece, leave your comments, and let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. Wisconsin's got a new reason to be proud. A Holstein named Gigi from Brooklyn is the new record holder for U.S. milk production. Bob Benke from Burwell Holsteins is her owner. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you celebrate when you found out that Gigi, your cow, broke the world record for milk production?
My wife and I went out for an ice cream cone.
And tell us, how much milk does Gigi produce?
For the entire year, it was 74,650 pounds of milk, which translates to 23 gallons of milk per day.
How much milk does the average Holstein produce?
I believe the average is 24,000 pounds of milk.
And is this all natural, or are there hormones part of the picture here?
All natural, no synthetic additives at all.
And I heard this is a smart cow, maybe not your average cow. She knows how to unlatch her gate.
She does. There's been many times where we have come home from certain places and this big black cow is out in front of the barn grazing in the hayfield. It makes you look not so smart because this cow outsmarted you for the day.
Does she have a personality?
She's one of those cows that knows she's good and expects to be pampered, get that extra scratch on the top of her head, and, of course, the best feed that there is available in the barn.
Well, Bob, congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That was Bob Benke of Burwell Holsteins in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. He is the owner of Gigi, the world record holder for milk production. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.